Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. We're going to start today with Sean Nibb. Hi there, Sean.
Hi, Meghna.
So you own a small business in Venice, California, and that's where you're talking to us from today. Do you think you'll be able to hold on to your business, say, over the next few months or through the end of the year?
I think we will, given that we don't have another mandated shutdown, but I think we are going to make it.
Okay, that's good news. I mean, California has been sort of in the midst of another struggle with the COVID pandemic. Now, I should tell people the name of your business is called the Flower Boy Project, and it's a boutique, a cafe. Tell me a little bit about the business.
It's kind of like a bodega. It's a flower shop, a coffee shop, and a retail setup.
California was a little bit ahead of the rest of the nation. So when California first shut down, what was it like?
Well, we had a really great manager who forecasted this was going to happen. So we actually shut down about 4 days before it was mandated. And we have a lot of young people working with us, and they were very nervous. So we shut down and let everybody go and just sat back. I mean, we had no idea what was going to happen. So,
and you closed for how long? For 3 months?
Yep. We closed for 3 months and we opened up about 3 weeks ago and we are running half capacity and we're running limited hours. We had residual projects that were still going. 65% of them immediately disappeared, but there were those few who were far along in the process that we kept going. But Flower Boy and our main love was closed.
So what impact did that have on your family?
Nothing at first. I mean, I think, you know, we have two children. We got to spend a lot of time with them. We got to kind of think about what it meant to be closed. And then came the process of trying to apply for a PPP loan.
Right. So that's the Paycheck Protection Plan from the federal government, which, as most people know, was a hugely fraught experience for many of the small businesses that applied for PPP. Did you get it?
We were with Chase. We tried with them. We weren't able to do that. We tried with Wells Fargo and we were shut out. And the mad scramble began to find another vendor or another, you know, bank that was going to give us the platform to apply. And we spent about 3.5 days on the computer, basically freaking out and trying to figure out where and how to apply. And it seemed like both of us were just all hands on deck. And we had an old accountant, an old bookkeeper, and everyone just trying to figure out the paperwork, the process, the calculations, and eventually at the end of it, we got denied. And then I went into the bank. I tried to, you know, ask about it to Wells Fargo and ask, you know, what do we need to do to get this resource? And he said, just wait. And funnily enough, a couple of days later, we were just checking bank records, bank accounts, et cetera, online. And it said, oh, you are now eligible. And we then pressed send. We had all the documents from previous submissions and pressed send. Within 2 days, we got the money.
Wow.
And I hope that gives you an insight into how stressful it was.
I have yet to hear from a small business owner that the process was anything but stressful, to be perfectly honest. But then the stress didn't end, from what I understand. Like, you got the PPP funds, but you had to use it, right? And it's meant for paychecks for your employees at the Flower Boy Project. Could you get them to come back in? I mean, the pandemic was still raging.
No. You know, and we're talking about a young staff between early 20s to mid 30s. And the ones that went away to sort of like, let's say to Montana, were like, well, we'll come back, but, you know, let us know when you're going to open. And the others that were here in Los Angeles were really unnerved by the pandemic and just what they didn't know.
Right. So the concern about health and well-being paramount, even though I'm presuming that as the business owners, you were in reopening, you were putting everyone's health and safety as goal number one. But also, are the people that work for you, are they mostly baristas? I mean, how was what they could earn at Flower Boy Project? How did that compare to the, for example, the unemployment they were getting?
Well, everyone was making more being unemployed than they were being a barista. And, you know, you're talking about a very creative, dynamic person, but they're still making about anywhere from $22 to $25 an hour on average. And with, I think my calculation, correct me if I'm wrong, I think with the maximum amount of unemployment and the additional benefit, I think they were close to $70,000 a year, if that was going on for a full year.
So you have to find another way to, I don't want to say convince, but there have to be other aspects of working for Flower Boy Project that can't really be measured in dollars and cents, right?
Yes. I mean, I think that Stella and I looked around and tried to figure who we could get to come and reposition the shop. Repositioning meaning that we took some of the funds and did things like opened up the back door to make it so that you could walk from the front to the back, installed glass, changed the flooring to make the space feel clean and white and bright. And then I think everyone who's been a part of our team really missed, I guess, the community and the camaraderie that everybody had. And we managed to get three people to say, okay, we would come back. And Stella said, okay, I'll work there. And then I said, okay, I'm not really working anymore, so I'll take care of the kids. And let's see if we can open back up and just break even. And that was our strategy. And that's, it's so crazy to think about it. That was the plan.
A couple more questions, Sean, if I could. There's the pandemic. And then there is also, you know, ongoing this reawakening about issues of racial inequality and injustice. We had weeks and weeks of protests in cities across the country in June, including in Los Angeles. How was that for you and your business?
So I'm Jamaican, Stella is Danish, and we have two boys. So we are a Black-owned, women-run business. And we were in the house and we realized that we couldn't bring the children out to be a part of the demonstrations because we were scared and they're 3 and 5. And we then realized that we were on a major street with glass frontage and realizing that at that moment we had just put everything back into the store. We had redone the floors. We had spent everything. And it's strange because, like, for the first time, I felt like completely, I just wasn't able to even help myself at that moment. I was just at the mercy of whatever was going to happen. And we thought, well, if someone breaks into the store, because everything, all the merchandise is back in there and it looks nice, what are we going to do? We're not going to be able to buy it all back again. It's, you know, three times the PPP money. We were done. And I think we just looked at each other and went, oh, well, being terrified, freaking out, knowing you can't do anything. We're just like, well, this is it. We'll just sit here and I'll drive up there tomorrow morning and we'll pray that it's hasn't been destroyed. And I just remember getting in the car and going there and we're like, oh man, like we're gonna, like we missed the bullet and we're gonna make it. And never thought that we would be now considered kind of a beacon because we're a Black-owned business that's, you know, championed by and run by women. But all of those things now mean something, and we're happy to be a part of the community, and hopefully, you know, we'll get back to where we were at the end of last year.
Yeah. Sean, I've got one more question for you. I'm thinking about how you, at the start of our conversation, you said that for now you think that the business can hold on through the end of this year, which is great news for now. But I also hear what you're saying, that you feel like you're walking on a tightrope, and that if you had to close again, that would mean the end of your business. So what is it that you need to help keep you, help stay open, help hold on to this business?
Well, I think we're getting help from the landlords, who are very sympathetic and have owned these few storefronts for generations, I think two and a half, three. And we need people to feel like there's a general safety and there's a general understanding, and that we are all kind of working towards some resolution or some common, like, solution to the problem, which is so much uncertainty, so much, like, mixed messages, and that it's at some point, we don't know when, that it'll be okay to engage and to pick up again where we left off, like start to come back to those rituals and those things that made us feel connected. The uncertainty is a business killer.
Yeah. Well, Sean Nibb is owner of Flower Boy Project, a boutique cafe and flower shop in Venice, California. He's also owner of Nibb Design Interiors. Sean, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me, Magna.
Now, Sean talked about common solutions and battling back uncertainty. And one way to do that is with good information. So when we come back, we're going to talk about a project that's trying to get faster and more detailed economic information about what's happening in this pandemic into the hands of policymakers. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Good morning. As we come on the air, we are expecting at any moment the government to release its monthly jobs report, the clearest snapshot.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics is reporting a 13.3% unemployment rate, a 1.4% improvement since April, but also acknowledging an error in how it classifies employment status.
The Labor Department has just released its unemployment report for the month of June. It will show us how the...
For each diagnosed case of COVID-19, 35 Americans have lost their jobs in the last 4 weeks.
Essentially, this report is a sign the deep, deep hole in the job market isn't getting deeper.
Now, those are some headlines from federal economics reports. We've all heard them before. But today we're talking about why in this pandemic, and quite frankly in modern America, there's an urgent need for faster, more granular, more accurate data about what's really happening to American livelihoods. Just before the break, we heard the story of a small business owner in Venice, California. Joining us now is Raj Chetty. He's a professor of economics at Harvard University. He's a MacArthur Genius Grant winner and a winner of some of the highest awards in the field of economics. He's also director of Opportunity Insights. They use big data to understand how to give children from disadvantaged backgrounds better chances at succeeding. And they've got some really incredible new insights about what's actually happening on the ground in this pandemic. So Professor Chetty, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Magna. Pleasure to be here.
So first of all, you heard those headlines that we just grabbed from, you know, recent days where sort of jobs reports came out, et cetera. Why are those data sets or those reports, are they the most useful that we can get our hands on at this point in time?
Yeah. So Magna, the headlines that you hear about unemployment is soaring, GDP is falling and so forth, all of that comes from surveys of households and businesses that the government conducts systematically on a monthly basis. And those data are incredibly valuable, of course, in informing our understanding of the economy as a whole. But they have, I think, two key limitations. First, they come with a significant delay, typically. So we only know GDP statistics at a quarterly level, for example. So if you're trying to figure out what's going on this week or next week in this fast-moving crisis, often you're working with data that's a few months old. And obviously, that puts you in a difficult position as a policymaker. But second, and I think maybe more importantly, they don't allow you to drill down into sort of the local picture in how economic crises are playing out across people, across businesses, which businesses are suffering the most, where do we need to target support going forward. All of that is very hard to see when you just see a headline number like millions of people have lost their jobs.
So there's a big lag in the data, you're saying, a quarterly lag sometimes, or at least a monthly lag. And they're not granular enough. And I mean, we even heard in Sean's story before the break that things for him and his business were really changing from week to week or even day to day. So I can see that the urgency of having a data that's much more, I mean, real time is the way I would put it, but perhaps that's a little too ambitious.
I think that's exactly it. The term we use is near real time. So when people are swiping their credit and debit cards, trying to get a sense of economic activity a few days later on the basis of those transactions and getting that information, not just very quickly, but in a very granular way. You know, what's happening in Venice Beach as opposed to a different part of Los Angeles? And what does that mean in terms of what we should be doing for economic policy?
Yeah. Okay, so since you said that, can we just sort of play with the data sets that you have a little bit? Because folks who are listening, you can follow along. We're going to drill down. We're going to do exactly what Professor Chetty is talking about, and we're going to drill down and use actually Sean Nibb's business as an example. So if you have a device or a computer, either now or a little bit later, go to tracktherecovery.org. Is that the best website for people to use, Professor Chetty?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It'll take you right
there. So tracktherecovery.org. I'm going to it right now. And there's an Explore the Data link, so I'm clicking on that. And here we have percent change in all consumer spending, and it's a very scary curve, to be perfectly honest. But you've broken it down by state here on this page. So I'm going to click on California. That's where Sean was, or is. That's where Sean is. And we see, as of July 26th, that there is a minus 13% change in spending by all consumers as compared to January 2020. Very, very interesting. But you've also broken it down by sector. So I guess I should be clicking here on restaurants. And you have in California as a state, minus 44% change in revenue as compared to January 2020. Is it safe to say that huge drop is pretty consistent across the country, Professor Chetty?
Well, that is an exceptionally large drop, as you're noting. And we see drops throughout the country. But what I think is particularly striking, and I think fits with Sean's experience, is that the drops are largest in the most affluent parts of the country. So if you take the coast, for example, places like Santa Monica, Venice Beach, and so forth in LA, you're seeing very, very sharp drops in spending, in particular in things like restaurants and cafes in those areas. But in less affluent areas, you're seeing less of a reduction in consumer spending and business revenues.
Okay, so that is actually a very unusual finding, and we'll talk about that in just a second. But you know, your data isn't it doesn't just come in quickly. You're talking that faster speed, but you mentioned drilling down by geography. So if I click here on, you can go to the zip code level data for small business revenue. Have a zip code map, and then we can put in exact addresses. So I'm going to put in the Flower Boy Project's address, Sean's business address. He's on Lincoln Boulevard in Venice, California, 90291. Hit go, and there it is. His zip code is deep red, Professor Chetty. It's like the reddest that it can be in the map, and you have a net revenue number in that zip code for small businesses of -73%. That seems massive.
That is enormous, and I think it reflects the experience that Sean was talking about. I mean, it's essentially a total loss of business, right? So the average business has lost 73% of their revenue in Venice, and for restaurants and cafes, as we were just discussing, that number is even higher. We're seeing numbers like 90% in areas that look like Venice. And, you know, we've, of course, never seen anything like that before in the U.S., and creates enormous challenges, as we were just discussing.
Well, so here's what's so interesting about seeing the data in this way. So you also have median household income for that zip code. It's roughly $92,000 where Sean's business is. And then, since we've got this color-coded here, I'm looking just one zip code over, 90066, next door to where Sean is. And there's a -21% drop in revenue. A lower median household income, $80,000 there. What does that mean?
Yeah, so one of the striking patterns which you're picking up there, Magna, is that in areas with lower median household incomes, you see this most starkly if you look at central LA, for example. You look at center of the city, places like Inglewood and so forth, that are lower income than the coastal areas. We're actually seeing much smaller drops in business revenue in those places. And basically what's going on is that affluent folks, many of them have the capacity to self-isolate, to work remotely, to not go on a vacation to the beaches in Santa Monica and Venice and so forth. And as a result, in more affluent areas, you see enormous drops in consumer spending and business revenue. But in less affluent areas, perhaps because of a lack of choice, you know, different circumstances, people are out and about a little bit more, and business revenue hasn't fallen nearly as much. So that is a very unusual pattern. Usually we wouldn't see that or expect to see that in a typical recession. But the tables are kind of turned here, where it's the businesses that are catering to the most affluent consumers who have taken the hardest hit.
Okay, so there's a lot to explore there, because this is really, it is surprising. Have we ever seen that pattern before in previous recessions?
Well, it's a little bit hard to answer that question, partly because precisely there's been a lack of data. So just to give you a bit of context, how are we able to see this information at such a granular level, right, where we're able to look at the zip code where Sean's business is located? It's coming from anonymized credit and debit card data that we're seeing for a huge swath of customers. And then we're able to essentially add that all up and construct these statistics day by day. So as you swipe your credit card, that is getting aggregated up. And then we use that to create these statistics. We didn't have that kind of data 10 years ago. So, you know, you can't directly answer your question, what happened in the Great Recession in Venice Beach versus Central LA? But broadly speaking, we've never seen this sort of pattern at a more aggregate level, where places like Silicon Valley, for example, you know, very affluent areas, we're seeing incredibly high levels of unemployment among lower income folks who work in those areas. In the past, you wouldn't, in previous recessions, we haven't seen that sort of pattern. So this does look really different.
Right. So that's exactly what I was about to just ask you, right? Because this pattern of small businesses in affluent zip codes really suffering a lot. I was just going to ask you, but who's working in those small businesses, right? Because we're not talking about corporations. We're talking about the kinds of stores that Sean's running. I mean, he's got this boutique cafe. So lower income people working in those very businesses.
That's exactly it. So as Sean was saying, you know, he was talking about workers who are making something like $20 an hour, or perhaps a bit less in many cases. And businesses have to figure out how to balance the books, right? So you've taken a 70% loss in revenue. What are you going to do? You know, quite naturally, many businesses tell their workers, we can't, you know, keep you on anymore. And so you end up having a very large number of layoffs. And in particular, when you look at the data, you see that folks working in these affluent areas, low-income folks in particular, in like the bottom 25% of the income distribution, a huge fraction of them, 60, 70% of them have lost their jobs. High-income folks have been much less likely to lose their jobs in general. And low-income folks who happen to be working in less affluent areas have been less likely to lose their jobs. So it's precisely the types of folks who were working in businesses like Sean's, who, for very good reason, you know, those businesses lost so much revenue, they had to pass that on to workers.
Oh. Well, in a sense, though, these data seem to be affirming something that intuitively we knew prior to the pandemic was true. That, for example, and you, look, you're the award-winning economist, Professor Chetty, so just correct me if I'm wrong. But I was thinking, for example, when we have tax cuts that disproportionately go to the highest earners, that money doesn't pulse through the economy. I mean, it's fairly well known that it just sort of stays in those high income brackets. Whereas when there are economic policies that put more money in the hands of lower income folks, they're more likely to spend it. It's more likely to go into the economy in their neighborhoods, is it not?
I think that's exactly right. And we see that echoed in the current experience. So one of the things you can do with these data, Meghna, is not just study in the way that we're discussing here what happened in the crisis, but you can also look at what happens when you have policy changes, like the big stimulus program, which put money in the hands of many Americans. And we see a pattern exactly like what you described, which is that lower income folks, when they got the stimulus checks of $1,200 a person, roughly, they spent a large fraction of that. Higher income folks both received less money and ended up spending less of those checks quite naturally, because, you know, the reason high income folks cut spending to begin with was not that they lacked resources or that they had lost their jobs. It's because they were worried about their health and didn't want to go outside their house and risk contracting the COVID infection. And so exactly to your point, I think giving those folks more money, I don't think is going to be the solution in helping businesses like Sean's.
Okay, so we'll in a few minutes, Professor Chetty will talk in more detail about sort of the policy prescriptions that one might draw from these data. But I'm still incredibly taken by the granularity of it. I zoomed out a little bit from Sean's zip code, 90291 in Venice, California, just zoomed out a little bit because it's this very handy map. And the diversity of economic impact on small businesses in various zip codes, you know, just even a couple of miles from where he is, it's kind of incredible. I mean, we've got zip codes next to each other that are, the businesses are suffering almost opposite fates. It seems that this would be a pretty powerful tool for policymakers, I suppose, even like just say officials in LA County. So who has, are you working with policymakers in different parts of the country and giving them these data and say, hey, like you could do something with this?
Well, yes, that's exactly the hope and the ambition, Meghna. You know, our thought was in the age of big data, where private companies are using data like this to make better business decisions all the time, right? How can we empower public policymakers, equip them with the tools to similarly make decisions that are grounded in very high quality data? And so we've been talking with folks in DC, in state governments, in local governments to get folks acquainted with this new way of looking at it, right? So it's, you can do much more than just look at unemployment rates in the state of California. You can, as you've been doing here, look at this in an incredibly targeted way. If you're in LA County, you know, where should we be focusing assistance? Not just geographically, but across sectors, across income groups, you can cut the data in many ways. And I think that can be useful at numerous levels of government, from how we should structure the next round of federal relief to what local policymakers should be doing.
And is there a an eagerness to amongst the policymakers that you've reached out to use these data?
Yeah, I have to say, Meghna, I've been really encouraged that even in our incredibly polarized times, you know, sometimes people ask me, when you do this work, don't you worry that we're living in a time where often it seems like politics is governed not by data or evidence, and it's such a polarized climate. And what I've found actually is on both sides of the aisle, I've been talking with senators and congressmen and staffers, and have really found, to my surprise and encouragement, quite a bit of interest in engaging in the data. Naturally, people bring different perspectives in terms of what they prioritize. Is it about, you know, providing unemployment benefits or other kinds of policies that may be of interest? But I have found uniformly, you know, the sort of reaction of, wow, this is really illuminating, and being able to see how this plays out. And I'm going to try to take that in some way and fit it into the policies that I'm trying to develop.
Well, we are talking this hour with Professor Raj Chetty, and the new, almost real-time economic data that his group is putting together that give us a more detailed picture, more detailed than we've ever had before, about what is happening, the economic impacts of this pandemic, down to the level of what's happening on your street and in your zip code. So when we come back from the break, we'll talk about what we should be doing. We'll talk about more about what we should be doing with these data. So Professor Chetty, stand by. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the real urgent need for faster, more granular, and more accurate data about what's really happening to American livelihoods in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic, and how that better information could help lawmakers craft policies that really work. And with us to answer those questions is Raj Chetty. He's an economics professor at Harvard University and director of Opportunity Insights. They're a research group that's coming up with ways to generate and analyze these new, more real-time data sets. So Professor Chetty, in the previous segment, we sort of dug in a little bit into what your data sets are revealing. And the big takeaway is that in this pandemic, regarding small businesses, so let's keep our focus there, that small businesses in more affluent zip codes are actually suffering more because rich people just aren't spending. So given that one takeaway, what would be kind of your primary policy prescription? Where should lawmakers be focusing their efforts in trying to get businesses back on their feet?
Well, if I were to pick one thing, Meghna, it's actually not an economic solution. I think it's fundamentally a public health solution, right? So I think what is driving this crisis, the root cause of it, is fear of the COVID infection. It's not about government shutdowns per se. It's not about economic policies. It's just the simple fact that lots of folks are worried about getting the COVID infection quite naturally. And folks who have the capacity to self-isolate, to work from home, to not go outside as much, they are choosing to do so. That reduced foot traffic, if you will, is tremendously reducing spending and revenues for local businesses. And so if you look at it from that perspective, what's the number one thing that we can do to restore consumer confidence and ultimately increase revenue for businesses? It's to It's to make people feel comfortable from a health perspective, to control the spread of the COVID infection, to have, you know, appropriate social distancing, masks, et cetera, things that we think can be effective. And then ultimately, of course, find something like the vaccine that's going to restore consumer confidence and restore demand. So that is not an immediate short-term economic solution, but I think fighting the virus is the number one most important thing that we can do, even from an economic perspective.
Totally factually true, right? Because ultimately, people have to feel confident about leaving their homes, and the people who've got the money, who these businesses rely on, absolutely. But until that happens, Professor Chetty, we know that the government has shown already that it can act fast in putting money into people's hands. So, is a one-time stimulus check the way to go? Is unemployment insurance the way to go? I mean, what are your data showing you?
Yeah, so I think until we have the public health solution that we can really rely on in the long term, the way I look at the role of economic policy is to kind of keep the ship afloat in the time being, and in particular, to focus on the people who've been hit hardest in this crisis, who, as we discussed, Meghna, are low-income workers, particularly low-income folks working in these affluent areas where businesses have lost a lot of revenue. And so the way I look at it is, let's not try to use economic policy to figure out how to restart the economy, so to speak, how to stimulate demand and so forth, because our sense from looking at the data is that doesn't really work so well when the fundamental cause of the crisis is health concerns. Instead, what I think we should be focusing on is the social safety net. How do you help people make it through the crisis when they've essentially lost all of their income? And how can you do that? Through unemployment benefits, through the SNAP food stamps program, through other forms of the social safety net, so we can make sure that we help people put food on the table, get through the crisis, and also stave off a secondary set of consequences like evictions and defaults that would put the economy into a further tailspin.
So just to put a fine point on it, you basically see things like unemployment insurance, and you said SNAP benefits, as what, the most meaningful way to boost or support the economy right now?
I think that's exactly right. Most meaningful, and I would also say most impactful. So even if you want to just prop up total economic activity as much as possible, I would still focus on unemployment benefits and assistance for folks who have lost the most income. And so let me just give you a concrete example of why that's so important relative to a more broadly targeted stimulus. So what's the difference between the two? The stimulus checks, as you'll recall, the way they were designed in the initial CARES Act, it was about $1,200 a person, essentially for almost all Americans, except at very high income levels, regardless of whether you lost your job or not. So what we've done is, with the very high frequency data that we've been discussing, we can look at what happened to spending in America day by day around April 15th, when these checks were direct deposited into people's bank accounts. And you see a really remarkable pattern, which you can look at yourself on the tracker that we were just looking at. Spending is much higher in the U.S. on April 17th relative to April 13th, showing you that the stimulus really does have a big effect on total spending. But here's the key caveat. When we look at where people are spending that money, most of it is going to things like online retailers, so Amazon, Walmart, companies like that, where you don't have to go out of your house to spend. And it is not, in particular, going to local small businesses. So if you look at small business revenues in places like Venice, for example, they don't go up all that much when we see the stimulus checks going out. And so as a result, the stimulus doesn't necessarily get targeted at the businesses and the employees who've lost the most. In fact, that doesn't seem to have happened in the last round. Whereas if we give people unemployment benefits, it does go exactly to the folks that I think have been hit hardest. And so that's why I emphasize the social safety net aspect as opposed to the broad stimulus.
So what's interesting, though, is as you well know, members of the GOP in Congress right now, they see additional unemployment assistance as the source of a negative feedback loop, right? That the GOP would say, people aren't going back to work because why would they? Because they're getting more in unemployment than they are in their regular jobs. And ironically, Sean essentially said that that was what was happening with some of his baristas. And so I wonder what your analysis says about that, that for as long as a fundamental truth about low-income work in this country is that it's already not enough to live on. And now that on top of that, we have so many jobs that have essentially evaporated. Is there a challenge in unemployment, in the unemployment insurance, keeping people from looking for work?
So clearly, if we have unemployment benefits that pay you more than what you would make if you went back to work, I think there can be a serious work disincentive effect, right? It's just basic logic. Why would you give up more money to go back to work? But I think you can have quite a high level of unemployment benefits. You know, so if you were making $20 an hour before, having unemployment benefits that are the equivalent of, say, $16 or $18 an hour, various analyses that we and others have done suggest that the work disincentive effects from that are going to be pretty modest, especially in the current economy, where I think the fundamental reason that people are not going back to work is not that they've decided they'd rather, you know, live off of unemployment benefits. I think for a lot of people, it's just that there's nobody who has a job to give them because there's no demand at a lot of these local businesses. So what I've been telling folks in the GOP and the Democrats as well is it's very important to focus on sustained unemployment benefits and don't worry too much about the work disincentive effects, but ideally structure it so that people are not getting paid more than they were before they got laid off. So I, in my view, the ideal system, Meghna, would be one where you're getting something like 80 or 85% of your prior wages covered by the unemployment benefit system, thereby giving you some incentive to go back to work. I think that's very reasonable, but also giving you enough money to pay your rent, to put food on the table while you're facing the very real situation that for most folks, you can't actually go back to work, even if you wanted to at the moment.
Huh. Interesting. Is there anything that could be done beyond or sort of prior to the getting a handle on the pandemic itself, to your point earlier about the vaccine and reducing just community spread rates? But is there anything that can be done prior to that in order to get the rich folk, the higher income earners, to spend more? Because that seems to be one of your key findings, that they need to be spending more.
Yeah, you know, so that's a very difficult thing to change, right? I think it's fundamentally about creating consumer confidence in the right ways. And so I think, you know, smart ways of helping businesses reopen in a distanced manner that gets people comfortable in going out, giving people the assurance that others around them are going to be complying with, you know, wearing masks and things like that. I think there's kind of a what economists would call an externality. My behavior affects your behavior and confidence. I think sending the right signals can have a really big effect. But you're absolutely right that I think at the end of the day, that is the engine that's going to drive the recovery.
Yeah. The last couple minutes that we have, Professor, I want to step back with you because your career thus far, if I can just put it this way, it seems like one of the animating features of your career is this desire to find out what policy tools we have or can create that revive the American dream, right? Oh, and that meaningfully reduce inequalities in this country. What impact is this pandemic going to have regarding inequality in America?
Yeah, so Meghna, I'm glad you bring that up because, you know, I think a lot of us in the context of the crisis are very focused on the short run, right? So it's very natural to ask, how do we get people back to work? What's happening to spending at the current moment and so forth? But what actually worries me the most about this crisis is the potential long-run impacts it can have on economic inequality, which, as you know, is growing in the United States. And there's a worry that the American dream of being able to rise up in the income distribution is becoming more and more inaccessible. And so the reason I'm worried is one of the things we've been tracking, in addition to all this data we've been discussing on spending and employment and so forth, is educational progress of children. So the way we do that is using information for 1 million kids who use a platform called Zurn to do their math lessons online. And so what we can do with this data is basically look at the number of math lessons that kids are completing in school before schools shut down. And then when schools move to remote instruction, how the rate of completion of math lessons changed, you know, in the COVID crisis. And we see what I find to be a very disheartening pattern, which is that for kids in high-income families, there was a temporary reduction in learning as measured by progress on this online platform. But then pretty quickly, you see a rebound and they're back to baseline levels or even a little bit above in terms of the amount of progress they're making in online math learning. In contrast, if you look at kids in low-income families, we see a 60% reduction in the amount of math that they're learning. And that's an enormous gap. And if it persists, I think the great worry is that we have seen from research we've done in the past, a number of others have done, that the early childhood years are really critical in determining kids' outcomes in the long run. And when you have the 60% gap open up, you worry that we're going to be seeing the lasting scarring impacts of this recession 20, 30 years from now, where kids from lower income families haven't had the same educational opportunities that kids from high income families have had, who've been able to adapt, you know, through their family circumstances, through the different schools they have, to continue learning, even in the context of this crisis. And so, you know, that's one small example, I think, Meghna, of the kinds of impacts this crisis is having. More broadly, if we look across race and ethnicity, if we look across various other markers of inequality in the U.S., I fear that the structural factors that lead to an inequality of opportunity in America by race, by ethnicity, by income group are going to be amplified in the context of the current crisis. And I think that's something that's critical for us to keep an eye on from a policy perspective going forward.
Well, not just amplified, but if I hear you correctly, Professor Chetty, you're saying amplified for years, even generations, perhaps.
That's exactly right. And I think that's what's so worrisome. It's this crisis, in a sense, could be with us for decades if we don't act appropriately.
Well, Raj Chetty is a professor of economics at Harvard University and director of Opportunity Insights. It's a research group that's using big data and new forms of big data to provide real-time granular information about opportunity in America and specifically about what's happening in this pandemic. And by the way, we've got links to Professor Chetty's work at onpointradio.org. You should definitely check it out. Professor Chetty, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna. My pleasure.
Well, a couple of notes before we wrap up the show here. Next week and the week after, Democrats and Republicans will hold their party conventions in very unusual times and styles. We'll focus on the 2020 election, and we want to hear from you. What issues are most important to you as you consider the candidates? How engaged are you in following the campaigns? What worries you most ahead of the election, ahead of voting day? And what do you want to hear from presumptive nominee Joe Biden and from President Trump? Leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. And by the way, you can hear our extended, unedited conversation with Sean Nibb, owner of the flower shop and cafe Flower Boy Project in Venice, California. That unedited conversation is on our website, onpointradio.org. You can also continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Jonathan Chang, Eileen Amata, Brittany Knotts, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Bradley Noble, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Tim Skog, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sydney Wertheim. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.